All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're going to be talking about something super interesting, the reaction of churches in America during and right after the American Revolution. And the material you sent over on this, excerpts from Dr. Roger Green's lecture on religion in the American Revolution, that's fantastic stuff. Really gives us a lot to unpack.
Yeah, I'm excited to dig into this. It's a period where you really see how politics, this huge political upheaval, actually reshaped the religious landscape in America. And what I find so interesting is looking at the specific challenges different Christian denominations faced, how they adapted, because this period really sets the stage for that idea of religious freedom, which we now see as such a core part of American life.
Okay, so let's kind of set the scene here a little bit. Let's talk about the whole Judeo-Christian framework of the time. Now, we've talked before about the founding fathers, right? And the whole role of deism and all that. But Dr. Green makes a really important point here, doesn't he? He talks about, regardless of the personal beliefs of these guys, there was a clear moral and ethical, this Judeo-Christian basis that sort of underpins the founding of the nation.
Yeah, and he's careful to say it's not necessarily the same, religious language as earlier periods, like, say, the Puritans, but this moral and ethical framework, it was there. It's undeniable. He even brings up Marty, right? And Marty says that to get rid of that framework, you'd have to, like, fundamentally alter the American people. I mean, that's how ingrained it is in our culture.
Yeah, that's such a powerful image, like to imagine just completely transforming who we are as Americans to remove that framework. I mean, that really speaks to how deep these roots go, you know? And, sometimes people look back at the revolution and they think, oh, it was the super evangelical time, like a golden era, you know? We need to get back to that. But Dr. Green sort of pushes back on that a little bit. He suggests maybe all that intense focus on the political stuff, maybe it actually led to a dip in regular church attendance, right?
Yeah, it's a really good point. He's saying, hey, maybe the revolution itself was a distraction. Like, all this political focus might have taken people's attention away from their normal religious practices. So it wasn't necessarily this straightforward, everybody was super religious kind of picture. It was more complex than that.
So it wasn't necessarily like this peak of religious fervor that some people might imagine. Okay, so with that context, let's talk about one of the biggest themes that comes out of this period, religious freedom, right? It seems like a lot of things kind of came together to push this forward.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not like someone just declared, boom, religious freedom. It grew out of a really specific set of circumstances. And Dr. Green points out, first off, think about the sheer number of religious groups in the colonies by the time of the revolution. I mean, it was incredibly diverse. It would have been pretty much impossible for any one denomination to become the official state religion, This religious pluralism was already baked in.
Yeah, it makes sense. When you've got so many different faiths coexisting, it's hard to pick just one and say, this is the official one. Okay, so what else contributed to this rise of religious freedom?
Well, there's the distance, right? Think about it. The colonies are way over here, across an ocean from those European churches. It's like trying to manage a local branch of a company from thousands of miles away with like super slow communication. It's just natural that the local branches, they're going to have more autonomy. So that distance, that Atlantic Ocean, it kind of created a barrier, It weakened the control that those European religious authorities could have over their American counterparts. It fostered this sense of independence. And then on top of that, you've got the sheer size of the American continent. I mean, it's huge. And as settlers started moving west, south, everywhere, it became really impractical to try and maintain centralized religious control over such a vast and dispersed population.
Yeah, trying to enforce religious uniformity across that kind of geography back then, that would have been.
A logistical nightmare. And then you have the economic realities of the time. I mean, people were focused on building a thriving economy in this new world, and that often meant working together across religious lines. Religious affiliation sort of took a back seat to that shared economic goal.
It's interesting, though, because at the same time, England was also seeing this trend towards greater religious toleration. Even with the revolution going on, that cultural influence from England was still there. Dr. Green mentions the Act of Toleration back under King Charles II as an early example of this, the shift towards more acceptance.
So it was like this cultural spillover, even as they were cutting those political ties. Now, what about some of those more radical religious groups at the time? Dr. Green mentions them too. Yeah, he talks about the left wing of the Reformation and Puritanism, right? These were groups pushing for a more radical separation of church and state, emphasizing individual religious experience. Like, think about the German Dunkers, the Mennonites, the Quakers, the Baptists. They were all advocating for this. And, you know, take the Quakers, for example. They were persecuted like crazy at first, but then they flourished, right? Especially in Rhode Island and Pennsylvania, the Quaker state. And that really proved that a society built on tolerance and religious freedom, it could actually work.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about how much hostility there was towards the Quakers initially, and then Pennsylvania becomes so associated with those Quaker values, you know, tolerance and all that.
It shows how much things were changing, right? And this period also saw people starting to realize that you didn't need everyone to have the same religious beliefs to have a stable society. You know, the idea that social order and civic virtue could exist without religious uniformity, that started gaining traction. And then you have the first Great Awakening, which really encouraged independent religious thought and, in some denominations, this push for the separation of church and state. And, of course, there's the Age of Reason, the 18th century emphasis on rationality and individual liberty, which all played into the idea that religious freedom was the most civilized and reasonable way for people to live together peacefully.
So you've got social factors, economic factors, geographical factors, philosophical factors, all kind of pointing in this direction of greater religious freedom. It's really fascinating. Now, let's talk about how specific churches dealt with this whole revolutionary period. Dr. Green starts with Anglicanism, which is interesting because it actually seems like they were the most affected by all of this.
Yeah, you'd think, you know, a lot of the founding fathers had Anglican backgrounds. It was prominent, but the revolution really shook things up for them. Dr. Green gives some pretty striking numbers, too. He says an estimated 70,000 Anglicans went back to England, you know, loyal to the crown. And by the end of the war, there were only about 10 Anglican priests left in all the new states combined. I mean, that's a massive loss.
10 priests for the entire country.
That's incredible. Yeah. So how did they even begin to rebuild?
Well, first thing, they changed their name. It makes sense, right? Anglican, Church of England. That was all tied up with the enemy now. So they rebranded as the Protestant Episcopal Church, or just the Episcopal Church, you know. The term Episcopal refers to their system of governance by bishops. They needed to create this distinct American identity, you know, distance themselves from England.
Yeah, like a clean break. But did they completely cut ties with the Church of England? Dr. Green mentions they still had some connections with the Archbishop of Canterbury. Right, they kept those spiritual ties, but the relationship changed. Think of it like this. The Archbishop of Canterbury became more like a respected figurehead, you know, one among equals. Not like the Pope and the Catholic Church. They still looked to Canterbury for guidance, tradition, but not control, not anymore. And to kind of get things going again, they elected Samuel Seabury as their first bishop. But here's the thing. English law at the time said you had to swear an oath to the British monarch to be ordained. So Seabury had to go to Scotland to be ordained by bishops who weren't bound by those rules.
So even in their pursuit of independence, they were still relying on existing structures for legitimacy.
Exactly. And once Seabury was a bishop, he got busy organizing. The first general convention in Philadelphia in 1785 was a big deal. They realized they needed more bishops, so they elected William White as the Bishop of Pennsylvania and Samuel Provost as the Bishop of New York.
Philadelphia keeps popping up as this central meeting place, doesn't it, for both political and religious moments in early American history?
It really does. And Dr. Green talks about three key things that really shaped the American Episcopal Church during this time. First, they started including regular church members, lay people, in their decision-making, their general conventions, you know, reflecting that American ideal of broader participation.
So even within the church, there's this move towards a more democratic structure.
Absolutely. And the second thing, they revised the Book of Common Prayer, you know, to fit American needs and the new political reality. They took out prayers for the British monarch, obviously. And the third thing was this real push for unity and reconciliation after the war. You know, some Episcopalians were on the American side, some were on the British side. They needed to heal those divisions.
Yeah, to move forward as one unified church, they needed to mend those internal fractures. Dr. Green also talks about whether American bishops still need to be ordained in Britain. What's the situation now?
Nope, not anymore. Once they had their own bishops, those bishops could ordain new priests and consecrate other bishops right here in America. They became self-sufficient. And it's important to remember, Dr. Green points out, there's a big difference in structure between the Anglican Episcopal Church and the Catholic Church, you know, with the Pope having that central authority in Catholicism. He also mentions that there are some churches in America today that call themselves Anglican, but are separate from the Episcopal Church, which adds another layer to the whole thing.
It was a time of real change for them, adapting and creating their own American identity. Now let's move on to the Roman Catholic Church. They were a pretty small minority during the Revolution, right?
Very small, yeah. But their standing actually improved after the war for a couple of reasons. First, you had that growing atmosphere of religious freedom, which we talked about earlier. That allowed them to practice their faith more openly without as much prejudice. And second, Catholic soldiers fought in the Continental Army. They contributed a lot to the fight for independence, and that earned them a lot of respect.
So being on the right side of the Revolution helped change public perception.
Absolutely. It helped break down some of the anti-Catholic bias that existed. And after the war, you have John Carroll becoming a key figure. He ends up becoming the first bishop and then the first archbishop in Baltimore, Maryland.
Baltimore makes sense as an early center, given Maryland's history as a haven for Catholics. But Dr. Green then mentions some other important early Catholic cities.
Yeah, Baltimore, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, they all became important centers. But then there's this really interesting place Dr. Green mentions, Bardstown, Kentucky.
Bardstown, Kentucky. That's not a place you typically associate with a major Catholic center.
I know, right? It's kind of surprising. But it became the first diocese of the West, and the bishop there, he was responsible for this massive territory. Think about it. The Great Lakes down to the Deep South, the Allegheny Mountains all the way to the Mississippi River, huge. They picked Bardstown because it was kind of central within that vast, undeveloped area.
Wow, that's a lot of ground to cover for one bishop. And Dr. Green actually has a personal connection to Bardstown, doesn't he?
He does. He tells this story about how his church history professor would take them on retreats to the Abbey of Gethsemane in Bardstown. It's the largest Trappist monastery in the world. And Thomas Merton lived there, which is pretty cool. Dr. Green talks about the monks' vows of poverty, obedience, chastity, their commitment to silent prayer. And then there's this moment where he talks about an act of hospitality he experienced there. It's a really vivid picture of, you know, the unexpected places where the early Catholic Church was finding its footing.
It's a reminder that history happens in these surprising places, you know, not just the big cities. Okay, let's talk about American Methodism. Dr. Green starts by introducing John Wesley.
John Wesley, yeah, he's the guy behind the whole Methodist movement. He was an Anglican priest in England, but he was really concerned about what he saw as a lack of real faith, you know, spiritual apathy within the Church of England. And Methodism starts as this effort to renew, reform the church from within. It wasn't meant to be a separate denomination at first.
So he wanted to revitalize the Anglican church, not break away from it.
Exactly. And this Wesleyan revival in England, it happened around the same time as the first Great Awakening here in America. It was all about bringing back personal faith, piety, social action. And Charles Wesley, John's brother, he wrote all these hymns that really helped spread the movement. And the name Methodist, it actually started as a kind of insult because they were so disciplined and methodical about their faith, you know, Bible study, prayer, charity work. But they ended up owning the name.
Kind of like how the Quakers took ownership of their nickname. So how did Methodism take root here in America?
Well, before the Revolution, John Wesley sent over 8 preachers, missionaries. But only one of them, Francis Asbury, stayed after the war started. Wesley himself was against the American Revolution, actually. And Asbury, he becomes the key figure in American Methodism. He traveled all over, preaching, organizing.
So he was the driving force, the boots on the ground, so to speak. Now, Dr. Green mentions that Wesley's use of lay preachers and eventually his ordaining of priests, that was controversial. Why was that?
It was a big deal because in the Anglican Church, bishops were the only ones who could ordain priests. But Wesley, he was a priest, also called a presbyter, and he came to believe that, biblically speaking, there wasn't a real difference between a bishop and a presbyter. So based on that, he felt he could authorize lay preachers and even ordain priests to serve the growing Methodist communities in America. It caused a lot of tension within the Anglican Church, even though Wesley never officially broke away during his lifetime.
So he was really pushing the boundaries of Anglican tradition.
He was. And with the Methodist movement growing so fast in America, and not many Anglican priests willing to come over after the Revolution, Wesley had to do something. So in 1784, he sent Thomas Coke, who was an ordained Anglican priest, to America with instructions to ordain Francis Asbury as a superintendent, basically a bishop. And this all happened at the Christmas Conference in Baltimore in December 1784. That's considered the official start of the Methodist Episcopal Church in America as a distinct entity.
So that Christmas Conference was a major turning point.
It was. John Wesley remained an important figure for American Methodists until his death in 1791. But that Christmas conference, it set the stage for all these different Methodist denominations that would develop in the U.S. later on. Huh. And there was even some back and forth between Wesley and Coke and Asbury about using the title bishop. Wesley was hesitant to completely break from the Church of England. But despite all that early complexity, Methodism, it was small during the Revolution, but it was ready to explode in the next century.
It's so interesting to see how differently these denominations navigated all the changes brought about by the Revolution.
I know, right? It really wasn't just a political event. It totally reshaped religion in America. Mm-hmm. This pursuit of liberty, it extended into the spiritual realm. And that environment of religious freedom, it forced all these different Christian traditions to adapt, yeah. You know, redefine themselves. And in the end, they all contributed to this uniquely American religious landscape.
One thing that really stuck with me is the surprising role of Bardstown, Kentucky. You know, this seemingly out-of-the-way place becoming this key center for the Catholic Church. It really shows the scale of the challenge, you know, building these religious institutions in this huge, still-developing nation. And then there's Methodism. It's fascinating to see how it started as this reform movement within Anglicanism, and then it ends up becoming all these separate denominations. You just never know how these things are going to play out.
That's so true. And it makes you wonder, what would the religious map of America look like today if the Revolution had gone differently? This deep dive really shows how American identity and its religious development are totally intertwined. You know, you can't separate them. I'm curious, what parts of this conversation really stood out to you? What other questions do you have about religion and the founding of America?